Good morning and welcome to the February 21st, 2013 Finance Subcommittee for the Health and Social Services. Today I have with me Senator Berta Gardner. It is being teleconferenced and recorded, so please turn off your cell phones and Blackberries. This meeting is a continuation of our discussion on Medicaid. For those of you who will be testifying, please remember to identify yourself, your affiliation, and begin before you begin your testimony. We have an hour and a half for the meeting. With that, Ms. Jackson, would you lead off, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Senator Gardner.
You're probably going to have to pull the microphone closer to you.
Oh, probably. My voice. My name is Pat Jackson. I work for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium in the Intergovernmental Affairs Division. And just by way of introduction this morning, NTHC is a statewide tribal health organization that serves 140,000 Alaska Natives statewide. NTHC and South Central Foundation co-manage the Alaska Native Medical Center, which is the tertiary care hospital for the Alaska Natives for Alaska Natives. To better understand what Medicaid expansion means to our population, NTHC over the last several months has been engaged in some analysis. We contracted for some independent analysis from the Urban Institute and from Northern Economics, and prepared also a master report under NTHC's header, which I believe you have. And we also brought in Jay Livey into the umbrella here to help with the analysis. And today Jay will walk through some slides and discussion.
Mr. Livey, please.
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought today what I'd do is we have...
Please identify.
I'm Jay Livey. I'm working with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium on this project. I thought what we'd do today is go through some slides. There's probably 20 or so in this packet. Some of the ones we go through early we'll just go through very rapidly. You probably have this information before. If not, we can slow down and talk about them. And then as we get into the slides later, I think we'll want to slow down and linger over a few of those. This slide just explains the core Medicaid expansion. It was authorized, as you know, in the Affordable Care Act, and it created a new eligibility category for Medicaid as of January 1st, 2014. And that is a category of anybody between 0 and 138 percent of poverty. We'll talk in a minute about what this means. I should say it's also, of course, it's anybody under 65, because if you're 65 and older, then you go on Medicare. So I'm only talking about people that are under 65, 0 to 138% of poverty. And as a part of the Affordable Care Act, it also included enhanced matching rates for states, so that a state, rather than having the normal federal financial participation, which in Alaska is about 50%, although we can... For various groups, it changes, but overall, it's about that. And under the Affordable Care Act, the rate changes to 100% for the first 3 years, 90% thereafter, and we'll talk about that a little later also. The other thing, can you go back one more? I'm sorry. The other thing the Act did, it established what they call the MAGI, which is the Modified Adjusted Gross Income. And what that is a uniform method that the government will use to calculate income. And it's used to calculate income for people in an insurance exchange, so what to decide whether or not their income allows them to be eligible for a subsidy or not. It is also going to be the modified income calculation, the modified calculation for Medicaid to determine Medicaid eligibility. So now, we're moving toward having a uniform income calculation for an individual, whether they're walking through the Medicaid door or they're walking through the subsidized health insurance door or any other door actually through the exchange. So we're trying to create a uniform income structure to determine how to treat people within the exchange. Okay. Now, we talked about Medicaid expansion and the idea of going up to 138% of poverty. What this slide does is just, you've probably seen this before through the department, but what it shows is, it just shows you what the poverty rates are for Alaska. And we have 100%, 138%, 300% of poverty, and then you can see the various rates that apply to one person, two-person family, and on and on. We'll come back to this, but let me just mention right now that the 138 is what the upper limit would be on a Medicaid expansion if there were to be one in Alaska. So we're talking about $20,000 for one person, about $26,000 for a two-person family. I also want to point out, just to keep in the back of your mind, the 100% federal poverty level is important. We'll get into this later, because the 100% is the cutoff at which income a person can join the Medicaid, the insurance exchange or not. If you have income at 100% of poverty and up, you can join the exchange. If you're 100% of poverty and below, you can't. And I'll explain in a minute what that means, but that's an important issue later on. Okay.
I'm sorry, Senator Gardner.
What would be the rationale for saying people at the extremely low end, below 100% of poverty, couldn't participate?
That's a really good question. And I'm sorry, excuse me. Can we go to the next slide? And let me explain this slide, and then I think we can come back to your question. Because what happened was that when the ACA, when the Affordable Care Act was originally written, it was mandatory for a state to go to 138 of poverty for Medicaid. And then subsequently what happened is, you know, of course it went to court. Supreme Court said, yeah, the act is constitutional, but you can't make a state take that expansion group. Instead of a mandatory group, that has to be an optional group. And so states now have the option as to whether or not they want to expand Medicaid. But in the meantime, my understanding is, in the meantime, the law had been written as if it were a mandatory function. And so all of a sudden you have the Supreme Court case, you have the original law, you put all that together, and what happens is people under 100% of poverty drop out if there's no Medicaid expansion. That's sort of the dynamic of how we got here. And now there are people here probably know more about the history of this than I, from the department particularly, and so, but I think that's basically what happened. And so we've created this sort of donut hole of people that we need to think about.
So here in the state of Alaska, 100%, if you're 100% of poverty and below, you're not in it.
Well,
but in another state where you have accepted expansion, if you're 100% and below, you have the option of being in it.
Currently, Mr. Chairman, currently across the country, of course, Medicaid rules are different state by state. But in Alaska, historically, the way the program has worked, you have to be eligible for Medicaid, you have to be categorically eligible. That means you have to fit some profile that we've defined in our program. So you can be blind, you can be disabled, you can be a low-income family, parents and children. We cover those people up to about 81% of poverty. If you're in Alaska and you don't have, and you're a couple or you're a single individual and don't have any kids, you're not eligible for Medicaid at all, regardless of your income. Mm-hmm. So we have two groups in Alaska that are if you don't do the Medicaid expansion, that are sort of out of the picture. One is a couple with kids between 81% and 100% of poverty, because they can't go into the exchange unless they get up to 100%. And then you have that group of childless adults who are between 0% of poverty and 100% of poverty that are currently not eligible for Medicaid.
Okay.
So if you do not do the Medicaid expansion, the exchange will not help them.
Senator Gardner had a question.
He just answered it. I was going to make sure I understood that.
Okay, so that was what happened anyway in the law. And so now all states are at the point of the Supreme Court said you cannot penalize a state if they don't do the expansion. Therefore, that made it an option, and states are now at the position of choosing what they want to do. We talked about the federal match rate, that the federal match rate changed in the ACA as a carrot, you know, for states to join into the Medicaid expansion. And this chart will just show you. This chart will just show you what those rates are. You can see that for the first 3 years, 2014, 15, and 16, the federal government reimburses the state 100% for all the newly eligible Medicaid recipients. Mm-hmm. Next year's it falls until you get down to a 90% by 2020, 2021, 22. That's just showing that 90% continues. That's what the rate is in subsequent years. The Alaska Native rate, which is the middle box in there, continues. It's currently 100% for any Alaska Native eligible for Medicaid. Federal government reimburses at 100%. That will continue into the expansion group. That's not changed by this. Okay. And so then at the bottom row, you can look at it yourself, but what that gives you is a blended rate when you do the math and figure out the 100% and the 90% and the 100% and the numbers of people on the program and that sort of thing.
So as far as the beneficiaries go, nothing changes from now until whenever?
Well, for Alaska Natives who are eligible for Medicaid, doesn't mean you're just an Alaska Native. It means that you're an Alaska Native. You get provided a Medicaid service by a Medicaid provider in an Indian Health Service hospital.
Sure.
Those are the conditions under which you get Medicaid, the 100% Medicaid reimbursement.
And if you don't have a IHS hospital there, what happens then?
If you go to a private, the department here knows a lot more about this than I, but there are some rules under which referrals, I think that you can do a referral and still get the 100%. But basically, if you go out of the IHS system to a private doctor, private hospital, specialty, you're reimbursed like everybody. You're Alaska Native. You're reimbursed like everybody else at 50-50.
So you're in Ketchikan. You go to the Ketchikan Hospital.
I think it's 50-50, although they may have a contractual relationship that somehow affects that. I'm not sure. But basically, if you come from Bethel and you go into Anchorage and you go to Providence as opposed to ANMC, Alaska Native Medical Center,
sure,
it's 50-50 as opposed to 100%.
Okay. Senator Gardner.
So if the state chose not to do the Medicaid expansion and the people who are, say, single, childless, less than 100% poverty, or the other category, which is 81 to 100% poverty, a couple with kids, and those people are not covered then, and they get health care in other ways, or not at all, but if they get it in other ways and it's unreimbursed care?
Through the chair. Yeah, when you think about, you know, when you think of the poverty level slide we had earlier, I think it was $15,000 for one person, maybe $18,000 for two people is 100% poverty level. And when you think about what if those individuals had to go out and just buy an insurance policy, you know, out of an $18,000 income for two people, you might have to spend $5,000 or $6,000 on insurance. So that's not going to happen. I mean, it hasn't happened to this point. It's not going to happen later. And so those folks would still be most likely uninsured and most likely be showing up in emergency rooms or deferring care like they do now, not having a medical home, all the things in the healthcare system now that affects those kinds of individuals, I assume would continue to be the case.
And through the chair, do we have any idea what those costs are to the state and how those costs, what I'm trying to get at is how do they compare to the maximum 6% that we would
the only
pay expansion?
Before you answer the question, Mr. Levy, let's go ahead and call an ad. Call the Finance Subcommittee back to order. And Senator Gardner, will you restate your question again, please?
Okay, sure. There will be two groups in Alaska who would not be eligible without the expansion, okay? Mm-hmm. Those would be the couples with children who have income levels at 81 to 100% of poverty, and childless adults who have less than 100% poverty level. They wouldn't be covered. And when those people get care, understanding they often defer, they go to the ER, who pays for their care? Where does that money come from? What does it cost the state? And how does that total amount compare to the maximum 10% or 6% over 10 years that the expansion would cost the state?
Through the Chair, that's a really good question. To answer the last part of it first, I'm not sure how it compares. Because I think in Alaska we haven't yet quantified the first part of the question, which really is what you're talking about is cost shift.
Right.
If an individual that does not have insurance goes to the emergency room, somebody has to pay for that. Well, who pays for it is everybody else who has insurance, or else everybody else who's paying cash. And so there is a cost of having, there is a cost to the rest of us of having a population out there that's uninsured. Part of that cost to the rest of us will show up in terms of the state budget, will show up in terms of insurance for state employees and retirees. And so that part of the whole healthcare dynamic, to my knowledge, has not been tested, although I can tell you that I was looking at a report the other day, and in the state of Missouri, for example, their expansion report that they put out, they estimated that a family of four would have reduced insurance premiums of about $1,600 over the period of 2014 to 2020, because cost shift would be reduced. Now, don't quote me on that for Alaska, because of course the states are way, way, way different. I think that ASHNA, the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association, has been interested in this issue, and is actually trying to do some work on trying to quantify this very thing. Because later on in the slides we'll get to what are state offsets that this report has identified where we save some state general fund by doing an expansion. This piece of it has not been quantified, but it's an excellent question, and I think it needs to be.
Thank you.
Go ahead and continue, please.
Yes. Okay, let's see. So we've talked about this before, and I think that you have the concept, but this to me is one of the more important slides in the whole packet, even though it doesn't look like it. And this is what we were just talking about, and the question that Senator Gardner was asking. And all I want to do is make the point on this, that if you don't do the Medicaid expansion, then those people that are below 100% of poverty, not covered by Medicaid, will get no help from the Affordable Care Act. The Kaiser Foundation, in their state health facts section, says there are 47,000 currently uninsured Alaskans under 100% of the federal poverty level. So some of those 47,000 are going to be covered by Medicaid, because they're the people that will be incomes up to 81%, and they will have kids. Some of the rest of those 47,000 would not be helped by the Affordable Care Act if there were no Medicaid expansion. So this is sort of that's why I put this slide in here, just to show the relationship between the exchange and Medicaid and the expansion. This is just simply the next slide just shows that graphically. And we don't want to spend a lot of time on this, because it's fairly complicated to look at. But the first two columns show pregnant women and children. Because we already cover through CHIP pregnant women and children up to about 175% of poverty, there's no effect to that group of Medicaid expansion. The next two columns deal with that group we're just talking about, which is the adults with children up to 81%. You can see the red portion there. The red portion just simply is the people that are not covered between 81 and 100%. It's just identifying that group that Senator Gardner was just talking about. And then the next column over shows a larger red area, and what that shows you is that Alaska Medicaid does not cover any childless adults. So you have a larger red area there from 0% of poverty up to 100%. So that slide is just showing graphically what we have just talked about.
Senator Gardner.
And do we know how many individual people that would translate to? How many Alaskans would be in each of the
regions? That's actually a better question for the department. But I mean, logically, you would think that if you believe the Kaiser number and there's 49,000 people who are under 100%, you know, then you should be able to subtract the number of adults who are currently on Medicaid and get to a number of people that would be left over if there's no expansion. I've done that back of the envelope calculation, but there's all kinds of other things involved in it. Because there are some adults who are disabled, some can enter the program through other ways. My guess would be, and it's just a guess. I'd say there might be 20 or 25,000 individuals who would not be covered through Medicaid, but believe me, that's just a guess.
Mm-hmm. Follow up,
thank you.
Senator Gardner.
No, thank you.
Can you, Ms. Levin?
Okay, so let's get to some numbers then. They called in the report the Woodwork effect. And essentially what it is, because of the changes in the law, in the Affordable Care Act, that now require individuals to have insurance, we require an individual to go to the exchange. There's a whole new emphasis on individual responsibility and individuals becoming insured. And so what we think will happen, and what other states have predicted will happen also, is you'll have a certain number of people that are going to come to the exchange looking for insurance. We're going to find out they're Medicaid eligible. They've always been Medicaid eligible. They're Medicaid eligible under the current rules. They've never applied. And that's what this Woodwork effect is. You can see that by year 2020, we would expect about 10,400 people to go on to the Medicaid program under the current rules. Now, the thing to and you see the cost associated with that. I guess we don't have the cost up there. The thing to remember about the Woodwork people is they're going to happen whether you expand Medicaid or not. It's essentially in business school they tell you that's a sunk cost. It's cost the state is going to have to pay with or without a Medicaid expansion. And so it's an issue of having to, as a budget, you know, a budget body, you're going to have to deal with the cost, but the cost is not related to the decision about the expansion necessarily. Okay. So what this slide shows is if you do an enhancement, the top row up there will show you from 2014 to 2020 an expectation of about 39,344 new Medicaid recipients.
So you're doubling it.
Currently Medicaid is about 130,000 or so, something like that. So you're adding 39,000 to the total number. Mm-hmm. Additional Medicaid spending on the bottom there, it shows that in just raw numbers, that number is $91 million to cover that expansion over 7 years. During those 7 years, the federal government share of all that. Remember, because of the enhanced federal participation over those years, the federal cumulative contribution is $1.1 billion. So there's a pretty good ratio of state funding to federal funding as a result of picking up this expansion group, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. This just graphic, for those of you that like visuals, this is just a graphic of the same information. It just shows you, it's just bar charts that make it easier to see the ratio of federal spending to state spending. State spending are the solid blue at the bottom. Federal spending is the lighter blue above that. And it turns out to be, if you do the math, it turns out to be about a 12 to 1 ratio. For every state dollar that gets spent, 12 federal dollars, you know, come into the state as a result.
Now the 12 to 1 ratio is in 2020.
Yes, that was cumulative.
Okay, and then what about in 2014? What is it? What at this point in time, as opposed to cumulative?
Well, for the first 3 years, the reimbursement is 100%.
Right.
So, for the first 3 years, pretty much, all of the spending on the expansion population would come from the federal government.
Okay.
And I should mention on that, I did mention it before, and I should have. We showed you the enhanced rates that go from 100% the first 3 years, then it goes to 95, works its way down to 90 by 2020. Well, the way the law was written, those years were actually written into the law. And so a state does not get the 100% reimbursement for the first 3 years it does the expansion. It only gets the 100% if it does the expansion in 2014, 2015, 2016. So if a state were to wait, for example, to 2015, they're only going to get 2 years of the 100% because of the way the law was written. And it's interesting to think about that in terms of how the healthcare system works, because, you know, if we assume that there are some uninsured individuals out there who have pent-up demand for healthcare because they haven't had insurance,
sure,
and have just been going to the emergency room or whatever, you would expect that within the first 3 years of the program, there would be additional services being requested by individuals. Well, you know, for if you're thinking about just thinking about leverage and getting the most federal for the least state, it makes sense that during those catch-up first 3 years that you go for the 100% reimbursement. Because if you wait, if you have a lot of pent-up demand the first year, you don't go into Medicaid the first year, you wait, well, then all that pent-up demand is not going to come at 100%.
Senator Gardner has a question.
So that begs the question, if this were to happen, do we have the providers ready to schedule those appointments?
That's an excellent question, and I think that I think that's probably a better question for the Hospital Nursing Home Association or the Medical Association. I think there is some question about whether or not sufficient resources are available. I think one way to look at it is that a lot of these folks have been getting care in the past, but they've been getting in emergency rooms and other places, maybe waiting to not see a doctor and then having to go see a specialist. So it may be that we need additional resources in terms of space and individuals doing the work, or it may be that we need to realign some our current system, because people now will be impacting and I think entering the system in different ways entering in different ways. A lot more people hopefully will enter through a family practice physician or primary care or a clinic, as opposed to just going into the emergency room.
Follow up, Senator Gardner?
No, thank you.
Continue, please.
Okay, so we know that we talked about the $91 million that 39,000 people would cost us, 39,000 additional Medicaid recipients would cost the state by 2020. But we also have state programs in which we are currently paying all general fund for individuals who now would become Medicaid eligible. So if you did a Medicaid expansion, then you would obviate the need to have general fund expenditures. For example, we have a CAMA program in the state that spends $1.5 million, it's the first one up there, spends $1.5 million in general funds that is for individuals who are terminally ill or needing cancer treatment or in one way or another are among the most ill. Well, most of those people, if you did an expansion, would become Medicaid eligible. So you wouldn't need that $1.5 million anymore, so you would save that money. And you could say the same thing for in corrections. The corrections budget, I believe, is about $32 million or so for prisoners' health care. Now, half of that money they spend themselves, but in clinics and things, but a good portion of that money goes to pay for hospital care on behalf of incarcerated individuals. Well, because of the rules have changed in Medicaid, and so now Medicaid, you're eligible for Medicaid based on income as opposed to being in a category, most incarcerated individuals would now be eligible for Medicaid. So you could save some of that GF that's going to corrections by paying for those prisoners through Medicaid. And we have the other example we show up here is immunizations. The state has an immunization program that has general funds in it, and if for uninsured and underinsured adults, to the extent that those immunizations would be picked up through an expansion, you would not need that general fund money. Then we also list there, as Senator Gardner was talking earlier about some of the other ways, you know, through cost shift, there are some other examples there of other places in the state budget where money may be saved. We did not have the wherewithal to cost those out, and whether anybody could actually put a dollar or quantify those at this point, I'm not sure. But the bottom line is when you add up all of those savings over those years, you reduce the $90.7 million by $55 million through state offsets. Now, if you go down to the next slide, what we've done is they've added another row there. You see the row called additional corporate tax revenue. Northern Economics did this calculation, and what they looked at was the approximately $1.1 billion of federal money and the 90 million state money that's going to be spent on this group, and they calculated how much additional tax revenue the state of Alaska would receive because of this. Because all this money is coming in is generating economic activity, whether it's in housing or whether it's in travel or whether it's among profit hospitals, whether it's among pharmaceutical companies. And they've calculated that this money coming in will create over the years an additional $11.9 million in tax revenue. So if you take the 90.7, you subtract out the 55.5 offset, you add the 11.9 additional tax revenue, and you get to a number that is $23.3 million, which is the estimate in this report that would show what the expansion over those 7 years would actually cost the state. And again, that is assuming that no other offsets are found, discovered. Next slide simply shows that in a bar chart. And the large area, large green area there is the federal contribution that comes in as a result of expansion. The bottom two blocks are the state offset. One's the offset, the other is the actual state expenditure. Now what this one does is what this shows is the entire Medicaid program. So the bottom two blocks there are the Woodwork effect. Okay, we talked about the woodwork. Those are the people that you're going to serve through Medicaid. You're going to serve through Medicaid expansion, a result of the Affordable Care Act. It's going to happen whether or not you do an expansion. In fact, I believe in this year's operating budget, the governor has actually put some money in to the HES budget to cover the first cohort of this woodwork group. And that's going to happen regardless. The next box shows the $90.7 million, which is what the expansion costs. And remember, this is the $90.7 without any offsets. This is the maximum number. And then above that, you have the federal coming in. And so even if you don't count the offsets, you know, you still have a ratio of 12 federal to one state coming in as a result of the expansion. If you include the offsets and you reduce that 90.7 number by $55 million, then your ratios jump up to 35 or 40 or something like that to one. If you reduce the 90.7 number by the offsets.
As you look at the whole scheme of things, the first 3 years you're going to be 100% covered under the 100% formula. What happens if you take advantage of that and then opt out before 2020? Is there something in the law that would prohibit that?
No, I through the chair. No, I believe a state can opt out any time.
Oh, really? Without any penalties?
Because several states have chosen. Have chosen to do that. I think Arizona is the latest, mm-hmm. because what they did, they call it a poison pill, but what they've done is they've gone in and said, okay, we're in, but we're in only so long as the federal matching rate continues.
Continues at
80, or at 100, then goes to 90. They don't want it to fall below 90. Because there is a fair, you know, it's been expressed, a fear out there that over time the federal government will let that 90 reimbursement number drift down.
Sure.
And so what Arizona has said, you know, we're in as long as you keep it at 90, but, you know, the minute you start going to 90, we're out of here. And I think that other states are trying to protect themselves, will also, you know, may try to protect themselves that way. But I don't believe... and I can be corrected on this. I can be corrected on any of this, by the way, because it's not, you know.
We're actually going to have the governor, or we're going to have the commissioner come on up and.
At this point, it's largely an art, not a science. But I believe a state can drop out at any time if they choose to.
Mm-hmm.
A few slides now. Just these were slides that were done by. This is calculations done by Northern Economics. Through their state model they use, which takes in money and it calculates multipliers and looks at where the money goes and how it gets distributed. And this is their estimation of several aspects of the economy. The first one shows that through the year 2014 to 2020, through the years 2014 to 2020, you expect to see 4,000 additional jobs as a result of the Medicaid expansion. The next chart shows you can see the expanded economic outlook. And I should mention on these charts that they use, when they're doing this, they use a high, medium, and low projection for enrollment.
Okay.
And so sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm just the numbers I'm using. I'm telling you, are just the mid-case number that they've used.
So, what kind of factors would impact the participation level when we talk about high, medium, and low? I mean, is it not a matter of you're in or you're out?
Well, it is, but you know, you think about that's a really good question because, you know, as you think about this whole thing, one of the issues that we've been talking about with various folks this week is when you think about this population of individuals and who people are that would be a Medicaid expansion group. And we said earlier that the Affordable Care Act puts a lot more individual responsibility on an individual. And so one of the things that has to happen here is that although we don't know exactly how it's going to happen yet, at least I don't, an individual will have to provide some kind of information to the federal government so the government will know how to treat them, right? So you think about walking into a building, it's not a building, it's going to be a virtual exchange, insurance exchange, but somehow you're going to have to tell them what your income is, because based on your income, you're not going to know which door to walk through. But if you have an income, say Alaska does the expansion, if you have an income of below 138% of poverty, then you're going to walk through the Medicaid door. If your income is between 138% of poverty and 400% of poverty, which is at the point at which the tax subsidy that helps you buy insurance goes away, you're going to walk through the subsidy door. If you have higher income, you're going to walk through a different door. Okay, fine, you get your insurance, somebody pays, you know, there's all these machinations you get your insurance, if you're eligible for a 2% subsidy, you get your eligibility paid or your insurance paid. But the next year, somebody's got to come back and find out what your income really was, right? Because everybody's going to, and so you come back the next year and you have to file an income tax return. You file that return, and then the government, and if you said your income was 138% or 142% of poverty, for example, so you get some subsidy. Well, what happens if it turns out if your income was 200% of poverty? Then they paid too much of a subsidy for you. So in that case, the income tax system somehow is going to have to reconcile that. They're going to either take money away from you, make you pay more in taxes, or they're going to give you a refund if you underreported your income, or overreported your income, I'm sorry. So the point is that people now are going to have to be involved in the paper system we have in America of taxes and reconciliation and a bunch of other things. And so I think that there is some, it's a long way of getting to your answer, mm-hmm. but I think that there is some speculation that, for people that are marginally attached to the economy, which you would be if you're 100% of poverty or less, that some of those people will file tax returns, some won't. Some will be capable of filing tax returns, some won't. And so, depending on how all the system shakes out in terms of how people that are marginally connected to the economy are going to relate to this whole system, I think is we don't know yet. And the system and the act has navigators built into it. It has authority given to hospitals for. And to other providers to do their own eligibility checks. And there are ways that are built into it that are supposed to facilitate this. But it's all new, and so.
Senator Gardner, follow up.
Thank you. So this might be a little outside your bailiwick, but is it anticipated that every participant would get something like a 1099, some sort of statement that then of the cost of their subsidy that then would be part of their tax return?
You know, how the actual machinery, you know, within the bowels of this thing is going to work, I don't really know. There are some people from the department that probably have had to look at that because great sympathy for the department. They're going to have to, regardless of whether Alaska does the expansion or not, you know, they've got to figure this out. I mean, this is a big deal. It's a big, theoretically you can talk about it, but it is a huge deal bureaucratically. You know, from having worked over in the department and being in charge of this kind of stuff, this is a big, big, big deal to how to fit a government system into what is a new system being developed, you know, for the whole healthcare system. Mm-hmm. I can't minimize it. It's a huge deal.
But it sounds like if states like Arizona, which is an economically depressed state here, has been able to figure it out to the extent that they're being cautious and had the opt-out option, why wouldn't Alaska be in a better position? Because economically we're better off, we've got a smaller population, and we should be at the forefront of that.
That's a political question, and to be honest, there are obviously compelling economic reasons to do it. I'm sure there are policy reasons to give it due diligence. I mean, it is a big, big policy issue.
Sure.
And it can't be taken lightly. And like I say, the onus on the department to make it all work is going to be huge.
Sure.
So.
Anyway, go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. Finally, I think here's another economic slide. You can look at this one on your own, too. This is just a slide that Northern Economics did of increased wages. And you see the wages increasing to whatever that number is. I need my glasses on. $1.2 billion. And again, you see the three low, medium, and high participation expectations. And then the final chart, the next to last chart, this just shows the regional impact of the combination of state and federal expenditure on behalf of those Medicaid expansion group. Excuse me. As you would expect, the large green in the middle is the South Central region, where the bulk of our health care is, particularly our specialty care.
Sure.
And then the summary at the end. Just explains the what we've just talked about, the $1.1 billion in federal revenue, the 4,000 jobs, and the economic benefits, the $90.7 million it would cost, but after the offsets are applied, $55 million in offsets, you get down to about $24 million that would be the state expenditure for the expansion. And, you know, and I want to say one more time that I think the other issue about this is you get lost in the numbers and the money and the economic benefit. But for people, you tend to lose sight of what the personal benefit here is to a family or someone who's not insured, or the group that we've talked about before, the under 100%, if you don't do the expansion. You think about the way that healthcare can change for an individual, or even for a family and children, if you have that that confidence that your healthcare is going to be taken care of when you have a sick child, and it's the benefits to the health system generally about how we change, how we access care. And use physicians as opposed to emergency rooms and that sort of thing. So that tends to get lost sometimes in here, but that, you know, that is obviously a very critical issue.
Mm-hmm. Question, Senator Gardner?
I was going to exactly talk about that, but I just want to say I have a son who's in grad school in Boston, and he told me about a friend of his who has a chronic, incurable, life-threatening but manageable disease. And I said, well, this is really terrible. She's going to have to worry about health coverage, and it'll affect her job choices for her entire life now, because she has to make sure she always has health coverage. And he says, Mom, this is in Massachusetts. Everybody has coverage. It's not a factor for her. And that's really what we're trying to get to.
As you look at these numbers here with the offset, how reliable is that $24 million offset that you've come to after the state has spent roughly 91 million.
Through the chair, as we were looking at them, I think that we're reasonably confident in the numbers. Uh-huh. And I think we're fairly tried to be fairly conservative, not too overly optimistic. We did list some areas in there where there might be additional offsets, and so I think that we're pretty confident in those. And that if those don't turn out to be exactly correct, then there would be other offsets that would take their place, substitute for them. So, okay. I think at this point we believe that's a pretty good number.
Okay, and as you look at the number of Medicaid eligible uninsured people in the state of Alaska, you've estimated at 40,000, and right now with well over a billion dollars coming into the state is obviously going to attract people to. If the economy in the lower 40s continues to stay low, the state's going to attract some of these people that are still going to be Medicaid eligible, uninsured, and those type of people that are more transient. Have you taken that into consideration of your calculation so that the 40,000 may indeed be quite a bit higher, significantly higher?
Through the chair, I don't think they assumed that that would be the case, only because this is a, you know, national option. Most of the Western states will be doing a Medicaid expansion, mm-hmm. also, or they will, of course, everybody will be joining the exchange, and so you will have a situation in the lower 48 where folks will have generally as much opportunity for health care as they do here.
Well, I think between this Medicaid expansion and the announcement this morning that this permanent fund dividend just went over $45 billion, we may be attracting more people up here. And that's one of the concerns that I do have, and certainly hope your numbers are right. Any further questions, Senator Gardner?
That's what I was trying to do long division about. If we have 7 years, 39,000 people at a cost of $24 million, what is it per person per year? And it's less than $100 per person per year.
Through the chair, when you go back to that one chart where we costed out the cost per year, because of the offsets, I think for the first three or four years, you know, the state actually saves money because the amount that is going out in general fund to pay. And 100%, there's a lot of federal money coming in, and you get some benefit of the offset, so it's first 3 years, too. And so for the first three or four years, mm-hmm. this actually, according to our numbers anyway, actually saves the general fund.
3 years, yeah.
Any further questions? Mr. Levy, thank you very much for your presentation this morning. In fact, you're being awfully quiet like you normally are. You have anything to add to this? It's obviously a great big deal, as you pointed it out. What is the general, since you're the ANTHC person that's going to be essentially in charge, what are the thoughts of your organization?
There are other people more in charge than I am, for sure.
You're the person at the front of the seat in front of the microphone here. And you're a representative of them. And because people like us are going to be making those decisions, we're looking to you. If you're the advocate for it, what kind of justification do you have out there, whether we go or not, don't go? Because there's a lot of resistance about it related to the numbers that are there, because there's so much at stake.
And that's the reason that they put the investment into having the analysis done, and having it done not just for the native population, but what is the picture for the whole state?
Sure.
The tribal health system serves a lot of non-natives too, because in many parts of the state it's the only health care option available,
sure.
as you well know.
Okay.
And, you know, the ANTHC is anxious for all the analysis to come forward and to be able to continue the dialogue so we can get to a good decision for the state.
Okay. Anything else? Since you're the people that are at the front of the line for the proponents of this, the people making the decision, the highest ranking person in here is going to be the Commissioner of Health and Social Services. We'd like to have him come on up here and share some of his thoughts and ideas on how big this is and how it's going to go ahead and affect many of the uninsured people here in the state of Alaska that are a drain on many of the facilities that are there, and in fact directly impact the budget of the Health and Social Services. So, Commissioner, if you'd come on up, identify yourself, and you don't have to go ahead and give us a definitive idea, but just give us an idea on what are the thoughts out there related to this great big deal that's in front of us.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, my name is Bill Sfeer. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, and I will not be giving you a definitive response to
sure.
this. Thank you, sir, for that that avenue out of it. Lots of reaction. First of all, someone characterized this study as being a no-brainer. I think it is anything but a no-brainer. I think the complex set of issues that we have involved in the review of this are significant. I look at it particularly in light of the budget situation I'm encountering this year. I submitted the smallest budget for this department in many, many years, and still the level of scrutiny that we're receiving in both chambers is significant. The woodwork effect is going to happen regardless of what we do, whether we go forward with an expansion or not. Well, what that means is $20 million a year of additional GF, and going to $40 million by 2019. We're adding between 5,000 and 10,000 people, I believe, by the statistics that the ANTHC studies gave us, and we have to consider that in any consideration that we do, because the expansion is going to be on top of that. So, and here it's a 12-to-1 turn that we get federal money versus state money, but what's that one going to be? And that's what we're still attempting to determine, because our numbers are considerably different from the numbers that came forward through the ANTHC study. We continue to analyze that. We used Lewin as our study, for our study, and we continue to try to deconflict the information and the data regarding that. So there are lots of questions compared to Lewin, and Josh Appleby and I are and Margaret Brody continue to work on that. Infrastructure costs are going to be $5 million a year with an expansion. Those are not 100% reimbursed. Infrastructure costs are additional employees to add 25% additional Medicaid to the population rolls if we go through.
For how many years do you anticipate that's going to be the case?
That's going to be the case forever.
Oh, really?
Going out. Yes, sir.
Okay. Go ahead.
Because the additional staffing, the additional technology for expanding the population by 25%. Jobs. We hear about 4,000 new jobs. Well, I believe it was RAND that recently announced that for every new job created in the healthcare industry, 0.85 jobs are lost in the private sector. And because of the increased healthcare costs, they lay off people. They reduce job opportunities. I'm attempting to get that study. I have an overview of the study, but I've asked them for the complete study so we can begin to understand that. I get a little suspect to that because that's pretty heavy-handed. But the greater thing about the 4,000 new jobs that troubles me is, where are these people going to come from? And how are we going to lure 4,000 new healthcare professionals, paraprofessionals, either to Alaska or from within the Alaska system? We need to attempt to identify that. We've got 40 other states that are expanding Medicaid. They are going to be looking for folks as well to work in their sector. And so we need to identify that. The tribal health system right now garners about 40% of the Medicaid dollars that are spent on tribal Medicaid recipients. So 60% are going outside the tribal system. And I believe that the study is heavily weighted toward the majority of people going into the tribal system, and the advantages and the out years, particularly 2020 and beyond, are reflected in that. So, long way of saying, we've got to get it right, and we need to continue to analyze this, Mr. Chairman, and we have time. The exchange is due to begin enrolling recipients as of October of this year, and we can't even begin to charge the state the 100% funding until January 1, 2014. So we have time to analyze this, we have time to study this, we have time to move this forward. And, you know, we want to get it right. We have not even seen a straw man of the federally facilitated exchange that would be operating in Alaska, and they're supposed to be operational by October 1, implementing all the state regulations around insurance, implementing our essential health benefit package. They have lots and lots to do in the next 7 months. And in a query last week to them, I received the typical federal answer, soon we will have something to you. And we haven't figured out when soon is yet, but I'm extremely concerned. We have 7 months to implement this in the state, to load all the insurance plans, to bring a federal plan up as part of it. I'm not saying there will be a delay. I'm beginning to move my betting over to there will be a delay, so we'll see with that. And that concludes my remarks at this time, sir.
Okay. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Is the Lewin study available to us, and will we have a presentation on it?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, that's twice, two meetings. Senator Gardner, through the chair, Lewin study is still in draft. We are analyzing it with final feedback to them, and as soon as the governor is content that it's there, as soon as I bring it to the governor that we're content and the governor is content that we're there, it will be released. It will be available.
Follow-up, Senator Gardner?
I don't suppose you have any guess as to that timeline.
Soon, ma'am.
But for sure not before the legislature's over.
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that.
That's fine. It's been brought to my attention that a number of states out there, in particular Governor Scott from Florida, has recently accepted the expansion, at least for the first 3 years. Any thoughts and ideas on, he's a fairly conservative governor, maybe not, I don't know him all that well like we know this one, but what are your thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, yes, Governor Scott has done it as well, Governor Snyder from Michigan. That's the number one highest unemployment state and number three highest unemployment state. Mm-hmm. And both of them have strong caveats as to outs for them.
Sure.
Governor Scott, he's only authorized it for 3 years, mm-hmm. at which time the legislature will be tasked for renewal. Okay. And it'll be a legislative decision. So we continue to watch them. We continue to observe them. The other thing that Governor Scott did get was he received a Medicaid waiver to allow him to put every Medicaid recipient in the state of Florida into a managed care plan.
Really?
To assign them to a managed care plan.
So they're all part of HMOs?
All part of HMO type services, yes, sir.
Okay. I'm sorry, Senator Gardner.
Do we have any HMO plans in Alaska?
Senator Gardner, through the chair, we do not have any HMO plan. We have no managed care in Alaska.
Thank you.
Let's assume that the governor continues to maintain his the same stance that's out there. We're still going to have a significant number of people of uninsured here in the state of Alaska. Has the Department of Health and Social Services come up with an alternative plan to go and address this very serious situation, especially in light of the fact that you've got escalating health care costs that are out there and an escalating elder population where we're just starting to get the first flavor with Dr. Rainier's Medicare clinic there in Anchorage. Is there work on an alternative plan if the ultimate decision is not to go ahead and expand?
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that we're doing is we're analyzing how much it really does end up costing us. And mm-hmm. that's where the big issue is for us right now. I have $54 million in general fund in behavioral health grants, and 52 or 54 million. And how much of that can be offset by a Medicaid expansion? Those are some of the deep diving that we're doing is attempting to identify that.
Sure.
And how much are we spending, for instance, in disproportionate share of hospital payments to hospitals that can be reduced as a result of that? How much are we spending in other grant areas with the additional coverage? And that's where the deep dive is incumbent on us to look at it fully so that we can show to the governor that, yes, there's additional cost of X million dollars of state money, mm-hmm. but you know, we're going to save state money in these areas. And I know I didn't answer your question, but that's the best I can do at this point.
That's all we're asking for. Governor, thank you very much. And for any further questions, Senator Gardner?
Thank you.
There's no further questions. Thank you very much for coming on up here and having your comment. I want to thank Jay Livey and Pat Jackson for putting together a very excellent presentation. With that, I want to go ahead and state that the next meeting is going to be on Thursday, February 28th, and here in the Fair and Cab Room from 8 o'clock till 9:30. And there'll be an opportunity to discuss topics of interest not already covered and a question and answer session prior to the closeout. With that, nothing before the committee, we're adjourned.